Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Guys Guys Radio. This is your host, Robert Manny, broadcasting live on Wednesday, June 18th, 2014, from our studio in Harlem, New York, USA, America, planet Earth. We're here with William Wood as our guest this evening. We're really looking forward to talking to him. He is a best-selling author of 8 novels, and he's going to talk about 2 of his books. One of them is a novel called Sudden Impact, and he's got another one, a nonfiction book about a female serial killer called The Bone Garden. So we're going to bring him on in a few minutes. So let's check in and see what's been going on in the world these days. Let's see. It's June 18th, so I'll get off my high horse about complaining about that long winter we had in the Northeast, because now we have that spectacular weather now. That chill in the air has finally left, even though it was actually cool this past weekend. It's pretty amazing, but now the heat is on, and here in New York, it's summer in the city, you know, back, like they sang, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty, so that's coming up. I went to a ad agency reunion last night down in the meatpacking district, had a good time, and everybody was out all over the place, outdoor bars, rooftop places, and it's a big change because when I first came into the city, it really didn't have a lot of places that were outdoors or rooftop, and now, and even on the waterfront too, it was so undeveloped, but now New York's really, in the last 10 years or so, has really taken charge and has really started to really beautify this wonderful city. I mean, Manhattan's an island, so we have a lot of coastline there, so they've really done a great job. I give former Mayor Bloomberg a lot of credit for that. And everybody takes advantage of any type of outdoor space they can have in this city because it's so congested. It's interesting. I live uptown, and, you know, people are desperate for, you know, outdoor space and all of that, and there's an apartment, a kind of a catty-cornered across from me, and the people who moved in, obviously they got this little sliver of roof space, and they're up there, they're hanging up their laundry, and they sit there in lounge chairs, and, you know, and I see the woman a lot of times, she goes up and she straddles the guy sitting there, and as they overlook as their little sliver of view of Central Park. But that's how it is in New York. You take what you can get and you enjoy it, and that's what kind of makes New Yorkers interesting and kind of gritty, fascinating people. So we have fun here in the city, and it's even when things get down, people have a great spirit here. So what else is going on? In the world of sports, the NBA Finals is over. The Spurs kind of demolished any hopes that the Miami Heat had of the three-peat. I predicted the Spurs in 6. They won it in 5. I'm a little surprised, but they played such great team ball that it was no contest, and I think the Heat were exposed as kind of a one-man show with LeBron James. He is phenomenal, but I have to say this. In the 5th and final game, he took himself out of the game and sat down with 6.5 minutes left. If he wants to compare himself to Michael Jordan or any of the other greats of the game, you don't take yourself out. I mean, Derek Jeter wouldn't take himself out of the 5th game of the World Series if the Yankees were down 3-1 and they were losing 7-2 in the last game. He would take his at-bats, he'd get out in the field, et cetera. You can't do that. So I don't know why. I don't know why LeBron did that. And I don't know why nobody in the mainstream media mentioned it, because I was just shocked that somebody of his stature would take himself out so early. I could see if there's 2 minutes left, the coach takes you out or whatever. But when there's 6.5 minutes left, I know they were down by about 15, 16 points, but you got to like grind it out. That's just part of what it's all about. So, and then we have the World Cup going on, and Spain got knocked out today. So they were the champs 4 years ago, and I think they were also the European champs, and I think they won the Olympics also in soccer, and they got trounced by Holland, clobbered them, I think, 5-1 the other day, and they had their second game, and they played Chile, and Chile beat them 2-0, and so they're done. They're out, and they were one of the favorites, so it's going to be, I think, a fantastic World Cup. All of the bars, and especially the outdoor places in the city, are going crazy with coverage of the World Cup and the fact that the U.S. won their first game against Ghana. We play Portugal, who got clobbered also in their first game, and they're a powerhouse. That'll be a great matchup on Sunday, and America is really embracing soccer and the World Cup, so I think it's a great thing, and sports has become really international, and some of the big powerhouses, like, you know, the big countries and the historic legendary teams like a Spain, the big European teams, you know, they went down, and that's interesting. And now we've got in baseball, the Yankees picked up this guy Tanaka, a Japanese pitcher, and between him and Yu Darvish, the two top pitchers in the American League, at least, are international stars, two guys from Japan. So the world's becoming a smaller place, and that's a really good thing. And part of, like, the whole guys movement is about accepting change and celebrating change, and particularly when it comes to people, men and women, being at their best, everybody winning. That's what a guys guy is, and that's what it's all about. So that's my segue into a quick promotion in terms of just where you can find everything about Guys Guy. We've got Guys Guys Radio. All of our podcasts, there's close to 90 of them now, are housed and archived on iTunes. My website is robertmanny.com, where I post my blog. There'll be a new post tomorrow on there, and there's over 175 blog posts now, everything that has to do with life, love, and the pursuit of happiness. And then Facebook, Robert Manny Author, Twitter, at Robert Manny, and YouTube. We've got a lot of videos at Robert Manny Author. So check it out and have some fun. And, of course, the whole thing started with my novel, The Guy's Guy's Guide to Love, which, again, is a novel, and it's about two men competing for love, sex, power, and money in New York. And since then, we put together a pilot TV series, treatment and script. We've got a screenplay now that we just got some notes back from a couple of directors, so we're fine-tuning that, and then that's going to go out for official pitching, if you will. And I just signed up with an agency that wants to pitch me to write a Guys Guys nonfiction book, so I'm thrilled about that. So we've got a lot going on, and it's all about positivity. It's about helping guys be at their best and also having guys celebrate women's long overdue recognition and ascension. So let's talk a little bit about our guest, William Wood. He is a best-selling author, 8 novels and 1 nonfiction book. He was a deputy, I'm going to ask him if he still is a deputy district attorney in California, handling thousands of criminal cases and over 50 jury trials. 2 of his novels have been produced as motion pictures, including Rampage, and which was shot by, directed by William Friedkin, who did The French Connection and The Exorcist and Rules of Engagement, and also Broken Trust, which was produced by Jane Fonda Films. So he's, you know, William was a big deal. I'm thrilled to have him with us. We're going to bring him on in a second and talk about, again, his 2 books, Sudden Impact, which is a novel about a, I guess it's about somebody who gets into an accident and has to make a split-section decision when he hits somebody, and it's somebody in a position of power, and he makes a questionable decision. So I think that's a great premise for a novel because, you know, in life, things can change in a second. Something happens, you have to make a split-second decision, and things can go haywire. So we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about some of his court cases, and we'll also talk about these two books. He's got a whole bunch of other novels, but also, you know, court cases. I was called in jury duty for the second time, actually. I got called about 25 years ago, and I showed up, and they basically just released me. Well, when I became an official resident of New York, I got called a year ago, and I got put on there was about 500 of us as potential jurors, and I ended up being jury selection number 2, and I couldn't find a way to get out of it. It is my civic duty, but I really didn't want to do it, I have to be honest. And it was a big gun conspiracy trial, and it was all over the papers and stuff, and of course we had to get screened for not looking in the papers and all of that kind of stuff, and it was some serious stuff. And, you know, the evidence was overwhelming. But, you know, when you get behind those closed doors with a jury, anything can happen. One person asks, you know, was this coercion? Was this entrapment? And before you know it, you know, things start to potentially, you know, unravel. So when you get into the jury system, things can happen. And with William's other book that we're going to talk about, The Bone Garden, it's based on a true story of a female serial killer who eventually got convicted, but not of all of her crimes. And it was due to, we had a jury holdout in that case. And so I'm sure William's been through a lot, and let's bring him on now and learn all about what he's been up to. William?
Good evening.
How are you?
Good. How are you? Thank you very much for having me on, Robert.
Oh, it's my my pleasure and honor. I got to tell you,
I heard your introduction. Congratulations on the work you're doing, and good luck.
Well, thanks so much. It's I want to talk to you about some of like how you got to where you are, because it's the road of kind of going, because my background's in business and advertising and marketing, and now I'm making this second career, and you know, setting the platform takes time. And you have to do a lot of things and initially not get paid for it, but you have to do it for the passion. And then I guess it tastes that much sweeter when things start to fall into place. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got into writing books, you know, from your background, and what kind of inspired you and how you got into it. And I'd like to know a little bit about your, you know, trials and tribulations when you were making that kind of right turn, if you will.
Sure. Well, I got started. I wanted to be a writer for a very long time before I actually sat down and tried to be a writer. One of the things that I was lucky in doing was, as you mentioned, I was a deputy district attorney here in Sacramento County, California, which is where the state capitol is located. And that, for some reason, maybe because we have the legislature here, we attract a lot of crazy people, and a lot of unusual things happen here in the capitol. So during the time I was a deputy district attorney, I was able to pretty much handle cases that, you know, they were the usual bar fight cases, all the way up to non-capital murder cases, and pretty much everything in between. One of the great things, you know, if you want to write, is pretty quickly you start to realize that every criminal case is actually a story. It's got a middle, as you discovered when you were on jury duty. And it's got an end. It has a cast of characters. Some are good, some are bad. Sometimes most of them are bad, but there's a cast of characters. So for a writer, really it was an immersion that you really couldn't buy anyplace else. It was a tremendous experience, and I enjoyed being a deputy district attorney a great deal.
Well, you have to have great discipline, because I had never really – I've avoided hospital and courts for a good reason. Unless I was going to be an attorney, which I decided when I was in college, although I like to argue, it just wasn't for me. I didn't want to do it for a living, even though I ended up doing it for a living anyhow by being in marketing and advertising. But
yes.
It's very procedural, and even if the evidence is overwhelming, there is a step-by-step process, and it becomes incredibly, it's like watching paint dry, but I guess it has to be done. And then the wild card is, and I think, as you mentioned in the book, that anything can happen when you go to trial, because, you know, one person can have a divergent opinion for whatever reason, and then you're sitting in the back room as a juror, and you've got to get everybody kind of on board to make a decision. And to me, the most interesting thing is, you know, people get convicted of crimes, and the jury doesn't know really what the sentence is. And the case I was on was a gun conspiracy, and, you know, they had to do a lot of math to add that up. And the guy got, like over 40 years. And I actually felt bad about it, because I thought he was kind of a low man on the totem pole and just not very smart, and kind of was in the wrong place in the wrong time and just handled it, just uneducated, and handled it completely wrong. Obviously, he was so guilty and he did bad things, but I was like, wow. And you see the justice system where I don't want to say it's random, but what are your feelings as a DA, a former DA, from, for, you know, how the system works And based on your experience, I know it's flawed, but tell us, you know, what your feelings are after going through all these experiences.
Yeah, you know, the truth is, when I first started out, you know, I was hired one day, and the joke with the older DAs was I wouldn't get a trial my first day. Actually, I got a trial my second day, and I was so incompetent, it was really unbelievable. You learn, though, as you go along. One of the most valuable lessons that I was given was by my supervisor at the time, and he said, really, all we can do, meaning DAs and prosecutors, is make sure that the jury or the judge hears all the evidence, and that's pretty much the best you can do. Things are going to fall the way they do. You can't really tell, as you say, one of the sobering experiences looking at 12 people sitting in a jury box is they may decide that what you're telling them is accurate and true. They may decide it's not, and you can't really tell what is going to move them one way or the other. I did a case one time involving three illegal aliens who started a crime spree down in San Diego, moved up the coast of California, robbing, kidnapping, one shooting, and then they ended up crashing a truck here in Sacramento, so they went to trial here in Sacramento. And of the three, two were not sympathetic in any way, and one was relatively sympathetic. The problem, as I discovered later on, was when the jury got back, they immediately disliked two of the defendants, and all of them were equally guilty. But they decided one of them was kind of a nice guy, so they wanted to give him a break. The interesting thing was that the jury forewoman turned out to have a very strong influence on the rest of the jurors, and she kind of laid the law down to them and said, let's simply look at the evidence here and put aside our personal feelings. And after that, she brought the jury along, and they convicted all three. But sometimes it doesn't work that way. I did a case involving a member of a prison gang at Folsom Prison. He was in for life. He was in what was called a security housing unit, the SHU, and he was on trial at this point because somebody had smuggled a knife into him, and that was a dangerous thing, obviously, for somebody who was in life in the security housing unit. But he was actually very articulate. He looked kind of like Clint Eastwood when he testified. And the prison guards who testified, the prison doctor, they were nervous. They didn't testify very well. And the jury decided that the evidence wasn't there, even though it was overwhelming. The upshot of that case, after they acquitted this guy, was that one of the members of the jury, a woman, had fallen in love with this guy and started writing him notes in prison. The jury, of the jurors didn't, but one did. The warden thought it was kind of amusing because, you know, they read the mail as it comes in. And they picked up several of the letters where this former juror made disparaging comments about what a cluck I was, and so he would pass those along to me because he thought I'd get a kick out of them. But that's, you never can tell with jurors.
Yeah, my closest friend is a litigator, and his advice to me was never underestimate a liar.
Yes, well, or somebody like the guy in this case who had been in and out of the system for years and years, had been in courtrooms many times, he was actually very comfortable in a court setting.
So go ahead.
I was going to say, if you wouldn't mind, the book of mine you mentioned, Sudden Impact, which is the new novel I've done, that whole book really starts off, if I can, it's just the first line of the of the book. The first line of the book is, Officer Bob Quintana did not see the car that hit his partner, Tommy Enser. And that's actually how the whole story starts, because it's all about who gets hit, in this case a cop who's had a Medal of Valor. He's very well liked in the community. And the person driving the car late at night is a good father, good husband, successful judge, and he makes a decision pretty much on the spur of the moment to keep on driving. And the whole story then flows from that one line that there isn't any witness to what actually happened, except the judge knows what he did, and all of his actions after that pretty much tell the tale.
And I like the way you framed it with Terry Nye, the detective. He's on the verge of retirement, and he's got a young partner, Rose Tafoya. And Terry's kind of got his own past, and the judge is in the crosshair as a suspect. So talk to us a little bit about the book, what inspired you to write it, and how does power, it seems like power is a big factor when you're dealing with the justice system, how that plays into the story.
Well, part of the thing that interested me was, I think, that notion of, as you said at the very beginning, the split-second decisions. You know, we all go through every day, and we assume a lot of things are going to be the way they've always been. But then sometimes something comes out of the blue, and we're forced to do something very, very different or very radical from anything else. And it doesn't necessarily matter whether you're a decent person or a bum, frankly. Frank Stevenson, who's the judge, is by all measures a very good man. But he finally gets himself into a position where he's covering up a crime, involving his wife in the cover-up, involving his father-in-law, and it's just spiraling, you know, out of control. And you have then two dedicated cops who are looking to find out what happened. And so there are villains in a sense, but it's kind of a, I was interested in the idea that what happens to all of us when we're faced with a very unexpected situation and we have to make a decision. We like to think we're going to make the right one, but sometimes we don't.
Now, towards the end of the book, one of the main characters says, if you get justice, maybe you have to forget about the truth sometimes. Tell us about that.
You have to forget about maybe the absolute rigors of the law. I think the issue that you mentioned earlier about somebody being sentenced to 40 years, sometimes things aren't very neat and clean, and that's very clear in the justice system as it exists now. I know here in California, certainly, it's about the best we can do. There are things you can do to make it better, but you have to kind of go with things as they are. And as my supervisor said, if you're putting a case on, the best you can do is make sure that the evidence is presented and then stand back a little bit and see what happens. That was, again, what I was kind of looking at in Sudden Impact. I've done that in a couple other books, too, to be honest. The other book you mentioned, Broken Trust, was about a judge who gets into an undercover operation set up by the U.S. Department of Justice to look at corrupt judges. And he, too, suddenly realizes that he has to make a whole series of choices involving himself, the people he's close to, even his own family, that he hadn't counted on. That, frankly, is what interests me. And when I was a prosecutor, that's what I thought was very interesting about almost all of the cases. People were often put in situations, and sometimes they did the right things and sometimes they didn't, but that was where the story was.
So how did you get your start then? I mean, obviously you're very successful in your work and you wanted to write. What was the tipping point in terms of sitting down and saying, okay, I'm going to write about this, because I assume that a lot of your books are loosely based on things that you have witnessed in the courtroom and in cases that have been kind of around you, kind of in your solar system, if you will.
That's exactly right. I have very little imagination, to be honest with you, so it's pretty much things that I've either heard about or seen or been exposed to in some fashion. The first book I did was called Rampage, and that was about a serial killer, a particularly grotesque serial killer, and that was derived in part from a case here in Sacramento a while back involving a horrible series of crimes with a defendant whose name was Richard Chase. Chase was called the vampire killer of Sacramento. It was a very interesting case, but I didn't really want to tell the story of the case. I was far more interested in the story about what happens in the justice system when it's confronted with somebody, a monster like that. What do you do? How do you handle that? Is the justice system really up to doing that and actually doing justice? And the conclusion I came to in the book was sometimes it is, and some people rise to the occasion and some don't. As you mentioned, William Friedkin, the director, turned it into a movie, and he did an amazing job, frankly, of taking things out of the book and then using his unique style, which is very documentary and very visceral and hard-hitting, and making a terrific visual example of the story.
So In terms of your writing process, if you will, because I think this is of interest to our listeners, you know, you write in a procedural, very eloquent. I mean, there is a procedural aspect to your stories because that's what you have experienced. How did you kind of sit down and start writing? And then what was the process in terms of getting your work picked up and then taking it all the way to Hollywood and not only, you know, getting optioned and then getting a film made and then having somebody of such notoriety like a director like William Friedkin shoot your film? I mean, tell us about that, because that's an amazing story.
Well, the book was published. It was the first novel by somebody. I had no notoriety myself, and so the book was published with some kind of promotion, I think, frankly, it's just the notion of the story itself about a serial killer and what happens to him in the justice system and how the system deals with him. William Friedkin saw the novel, and apparently it grabbed him on that level, and he wanted to do it. The book was published, I think, like around 1985, and he went immediately into production on the thing, and the movie was finished in 1986. Didn't get released because of some other things involving the production company at the time. Miramax eventually released it, but it was pretty fast. That, by the way, is not typical. As you know, the way
right.
things go, there's no single path on any of this stuff. I've had a number of books optioned, and nothing ever happened after that. So you never know.
Yeah, it seems like the business of movie making is really about the business of movie making. It's about how do you finance a film, and
yes.
whether it's the studios are really not, you know, they're not making the films the way they did in the past. You could have like a rich couple. They like a story, and they're going to put some money behind it, and maybe you get Sony to distribute it, and then that gets some money, and then you get a star interested, and then that raises more money for production, and then before you know it, you know, you've got the financing in place. But it's a whole – it seems like the business has turned into like a jigsaw puzzle in terms of how movies get made, except for these big tentpole movies where, you know, these franchises about superheroes and comic books and all that stuff. And then there's a whole bunch of indies, but the movies in between seem to be about, you know, what star gets behind it, or what star, whether it be a talent as an actor or a director, somebody says, I want to do this. And then that's how you get the financing. Does that make sense?
No, I think that's exactly right. When Broken Trust was made, as you mentioned, Jane Fonda Films, they were the production company. But very early on, one of the folks that they associated with it was Tom Selleck to play the
mm-hmm.
judge in the thing. And once he was in the project, then all sorts of other things fell into line. So, it does kind of go in that jigsaw puzzle zigzag fashion. And if you're lucky, there's a movie at the end of it. The truth of it is, I think, whether it's, you know, the large-scale pictures or small movies or books of various sorts, always it has to be about the characters and the people and the situation that they're in, so that people find that of interest to start with. It has to be compelling, and it's got to be something that will hold their attention all the way through.
Well, it seems like, you know, the police, anything that has to do with the justice system as well as the medical profession, you know, medical profession, you have a life and death. Anything that has to do with crime is kind of good and evil. So those are the easier sells, if you will. There's built-in audience, and for a lot of guys, I wrote a rom-com type of book, and that's kind of my genre. I like to do some comedic stuff, but the men seem to want action, and what's your feeling about kind of good and evil after being a prosecutor? Has your point of view changed after like seeing like and talking with serial killers and then with, you know, the everyday innocent people who are just living their lives? How did that change you, if at all, as a person?
Well, I think there is good and there is evil, and I think it's almost that stark, frankly. There are things in between. One of the things I did in Rampage very deliberately was I put in a father and a son. His wife and one of his children is killed by the serial killer in that novel. And in the movie and the book, one of the strongest and I think the most important parts of it is what happens to this guy and what happens to his son as a consequence. Time and time again, when I was a prosecutor, you had to deal with victims, and it didn't necessarily have to be a violent crime that either affected them or somebody they knew, for the crime itself to just devastate them. I had a case one time involving an older couple. Their home had been burglarized, and the things that were stolen were of sentimental value. Some silver, some other items. So there was no violence involved. They weren't home at the time, but before the case even went to trial, both of these folks had died of natural causes. The shock of what happened to them was just that overwhelming. Violent crime usually, obviously, has much more of an impact on everybody. It really is the stone thrown into a pond that causes ripples, and you never know where those ripples end because they really do extend way, way out.
Okay, we're on Guys Guys Radio. We're talking with writer William Wood about his novel Sudden Impact, and we're going to talk about the Bone Garden in a moment. And we're on Guys Guys Radio, so. Let's get back. I'm going to ask you this one last time because I'm just curious, and I think our audience would want to know. So how did you make that step in terms of, I'm going to write all this down, I'm going to write a novel? I mean, and then did you do any kind of classic study in terms of, a lot of storytelling is about what the main character wants and why he or she can't get it and a lot of that stuff. And how was your process smooth in terms of you wrote your first novel and bang, it got out the door and then you're on your way, or did you have some type of hurdles to overcome?
Well, the biggest hurdle when you write a novel is you have to write the damn thing. So
that
was the problem to start with. Frankly, what I did is I quit the DA's office. One of the odd bits was one of the very last cases that I was involved in was the Puente case, which is the subject of the nonfiction book, The Bone Garden. But I quit my job because I didn't think I could actually work and write at the same time. I wrote Rampage, probably took about 6 months to do the draft I did. More or less I went broke during that period and the period of time getting an agent. The agent then taking it around to various houses in New York. St. Martin's Press bought the book, and things kind of happened after that were out of my control. So all I can say is really, it really is just a question of sitting down and doing that and making sure you have an agent who's pretty aggressive.
Okay. Before we move to the Bone Garden, let's just let the audience know about Sudden Impact. It's a dark, riveting tale about a Sacramento cop. He gets killed in a bizarre hit-and-run accident, and the hunt is to track down his killer, who turns out to be a respected judge whose split-second reaction behind the wheel threatens to change his life forever. So story, fast-paced story, murder, deceit, haunting past, and a man's dangerous scheme to fight for those he loves. I think it's a great concept, and the book is very well written and a lot of fun, so I urge everybody to check that out. Let's talk a little bit about your nonfiction book, because I think you have 8 or 9 novels, and then you have, I guess, The Bone Garden you'd consider nonfiction, because it's about this woman, Dorothea Puente, correct?
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I've only written one nonfiction book, The Bone Garden, and that's the only one I know I'm ever going to write. And the only reason I wrote that was because, unfortunately, it was a case that I was involved in and I knew an awful lot about. So unlike a novel where you can kind of manipulate things and move things around to make your points, in The Bone Garden I had to obviously stay absolutely scrupulous with the facts and the information as it existed. And that's kind of constraining. Plus, it's a horrific subject, and it was real life, and I just didn't want to do that again. But it's an amazing story, frankly.
Now, how did you feel about this? And this is an elderly woman. She kind of,
Robert, she was. That was one of her tricks. When she was
dressing
first
up.
Prosecuted, she was not elderly. She dressed elderly. When she wanted to, she would present herself as being much older and much more grandmotherly. But when she was picking up folks and going to fundraisers for various politicians, she dressed much younger and more glamorously.
Well, tell us a little bit about, because it's a fascinating story and it's true, you know, about this woman and kind of what was her motivation and what was her MO and how, you know, she used cream to mince. It was like, it's a bizarre story of how she kind of lured these kind of helpless people to their deaths by poisoning them. And the evidence seemed overwhelming and you had a holdout juror. So tell us about the book.
Well, here, you know, the first thing that's almost unbelievable is that this woman, Dorothea Puente, during the whole period of time she was committing not just the homicides but a variety of other crimes, she lived at one house at 1426 F Street here in Sacramento, California, in the state capitol, less than, about three-quarters of a mile from the actual state capitol building. She lived on a very busy street. And it's a very nice-looking house. It's a Victorian with a lot of other Victorians on the same block. In a very small front yard and a very small backyard, she buried seven victims. And this is in the middle of the state capital of California, and she got away with it for years.
What was driving her? I know it's kind of covered in the book, but do you mind divulging that?
No, it's very money. Okay. She was, you know, one of the very rare type of killers, apparently, are female serial killers. And among female serial killers, very rare, even more, are those who do it strictly for profit. Most female serial killers, there's an element of passion involved or something else. Puente was unique and almost unique in that sense in that she had only one motive. She wanted money from the folks that she either robbed by drugging them, that she'd pick up in bars, or that she pretended to be a nurse and gave them drugs and stole things from their homes, to the folks that she killed who were living at 1426 F as part of a community, a kind of a community home. She would collect their Social Security checks, cash those across the street at a bar where she had an arrangement to do that, and she amassed, they figured in 1 year, this is all tax-free, about $50,000 or more, pretty much every year that she could spend any way she wanted to.
Now, that, you know, in the great scheme of things, I mean, it's real money, 50 grand, but it's not like, you know, it's not 50 million or something. What was, I mean, did she have money to begin with, and was this just extra spending money, or and was there a thrill involved with what she was doing in terms of her motive?
I think you're right in the sense that there probably was a thrill in exercising this degree of control that she did over these folks who were living in the home. At various times in the community, she would pass herself off as a doctor. She pretended that she had a Hispanic background. She didn't. So she was taken into the Hispanic community in many ways. So she was able to con people in that sense. And I think there's also an element of this kind of personality that gets a terrific thrill out of just the successful con. But for her purposes, she came from a very poor background. Her parents broke up when she was younger, and she was in various sorts of minor league crimes, up to and including prostitution for years. And then at the point that she began to lose her looks, she, I think, looked around for something more lucrative and something she could do. And she seized on this this gambit of presenting herself as a caregiver, and she practiced that pretty much all the way through to the point where she was arrested.
So what tripped her up? Two questions here. What tripped her up, and how did you get involved in the case?
Well, the first thing, when I was a deputy DA at the time, and I started getting phone calls from the Sacramento Police Department telling me that there were going to be some cases coming through involving a woman who seemed to be an older, even elderly woman, and they didn't seem that serious, the theft of some coins, the theft of a ring, this kind of thing. But the detectives who were calling me were saying, there's a lot more coming, and there's a lot worse going on, so I shouldn't just treat these as what they appeared to be, which was kind of minor crimes. So over a very short period of time, she was in and out of the courthouse, being arrested and charged and then bailing and arrested and charged on about five cases I had. And what was happening was the police had gotten suspicious because several women, very elderly women, that Puente had been caring for as a nurse. She was a bogus nurse. These women would get very sick while they were in her care. They would go into the hospital. They would get well. And the minute they were back in her care, they got sick again, and things were vanishing from their homes. So this started to arouse some suspicion at that time. And that's where I got involved in the case because it became clear there was a pattern. After I talked with one of the older victims, he described just a very bizarre circumstance. He was at a bar here in Sacramento. He's an older gentleman. She approached him. They had a conversation, had a few drinks. He invited her back to his apartment, and no sooner had he gotten back to his apartment than he essentially passed out to the point where he couldn't move, but he was able to watch her. She took rings off his fingers, began to loot various parts of the house, and he was very credible, and it was pretty clear that he'd been drugged. He hadn't been drinking, he'd been drugged.
Now, there's a passage in the book where the cops kind of go out to her house, and they're going to start digging around, and she claims that there's nothing there, and then she kind of, they dig, and they find somebody, and then she's kind of slipped away. Tell us about that a little bit.
That became notorious. It affected the police department very, very much because the detectives involved suffered as a consequence. What had happened was Puente was sent to prison on the cases I just described to you for about 5 years. She got out, went back to F Street, and had people living there. A social worker here in town, she became suspicious after a while because she was losing contact with several of her clients. So she got in touch with the police on, I guess it was Veterans Day weekend in 1988. Two detectives went to F Street to talk to Puente because they were concerned about a missing guy named Bert Montoya, who was developmentally disabled, very friendly, and he just hadn't been seen for several weeks. So that's who they were looking for. They didn't find him, but John Cabrera, who was the lead detective on the case, John describes very vividly how he went to the backyard, and he was looking around there, and he noticed a newly planted fruit tree. And there was something about it, he said, that just didn't look right to him. So he started poking around it, and he pulled up what he thought was some piece of cloth or leather, and he said he was kind of shocked when he realized it was dried skin. They started digging, and they did find a mummified body there, and they realized, of course, that couldn't be Montoya because he hadn't been missing that long. So they found one body, and they confronted Puente, and she said she had no idea who that was and what was going on. Part of the problem for the police at that time was it wasn't the person they were looking for, and they had no idea what was going on. She said she wanted to get a cup of coffee, and they escorted her just about half a block away to a hotel where she was going to get a cup of coffee, and she ducked out and vanished, which triggered a nationwide, actually an international manhunt for her that lasted about a week.
Now, I assume that that was kind of a boo-boo on the part of the police to let somebody like that, you know, slip away so easily. I mean, it seems so, ridiculous, but I guess it happens, right?
It does. Part of the problem was that when Cabrera and his partner went back, they found another body almost immediately, and at that point, Cabrera took off running back to the hotel, but Puente was already gone at that stage. The interesting thing is that came out subsequently was that what she had done is she hadn't left the country, which was one of the fears. She'd actually gone to Los Angeles, checked into a hotel there, motel, and almost immediately she went to a nearby bar and was picking up another elderly gentleman and talking to him about making Thanksgiving dinner for him and how he could increase his Social Security check.
Jeepers.
So she was totally, totally audacious.
How did you feel? I know it's your job and everything, but when you were confronted with this case and you could see the cold-hearted aspects of it, did that have a reaction? Do you get a reaction as a prosecutor to say, I'm going to nail this person every once in a while, or is it all strictly business?
Well, in her case, it was, yes, you wanted to nail her. I have to tell you that one of the really shocking things for me was that I felt fairly pleased with the fact she was going to be in prison. What I was not pleased about, and it really did shock me, was the day she was sentenced to prison. This is before anything about murders had even been suggested. I got a phone call from a family, and they said they just read about her sentencing in the paper, and they wanted to come and talk to me because they believed she had killed their mother just about mm-hmm. 2 weeks earlier. So
yikes.
That was the first instance.
Now, did you have a lot of face time with her?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, she talked to Cabrera, the detective, once and actually made a statement when she was being brought back from Los Angeles to Sacramento on a plane chartered by a TV station here in town. But other than that, no, she said absolutely nothing. She never testified during her preliminary hearing. She never testified during her trial. She never made a statement publicly at all.
Now, let's delve into the trial a little bit, because when you got to the jury component of it, it seemed like it was a slam dunk case across the board. There was a lot of different counts, and it was interesting to me because when I was at the case I sat in at, there was, I don't know, 16, 18 counts, and it was like bang, bang, bang. Everyone, it was across the board. They had very good evidence, and it just seemed like a no-brainer. But, of course, one of the jurors was like, well, maybe it was entrapment. Like, maybe this guy was tricked or whatever. And, you know, then other jurors kind of stepped up and said, you know, no. And there was a lot of reasons why. I don't want to get into particulars because it's, you know, something I sat through. And but when we're dealing with this person, Dorothea Puente, it seemed like all the evidence was there, that you guys did a spectacular job, and you had this one juror held out. And he basically, it sounded like, from what I read, he didn't want to have the responsibility of making a decision. So talk to us about that, because it seems like I kept wondering, like, why didn't this guy get screened out? And I know you can't screen for everything, but he's like a bad juror.
No, you're right, Robert. Here, the problem was that the prosecutor who handled the case was probably the most experienced major crime prosecutor, well, probably in California, John O'Mara, and he spent, oh golly, it was at least 4 months picking that jury, meaning going through jury panels. They went through multiple jury panels, hundreds of people, before they finally settled on the 12 jurors, and I don't remember how many alternates. And his questioning was exhaustive. The judge questioned. The defense attorneys obviously questioned. But there was one juror on there who looked at Puente, who sat pretty much in her grandmotherly appearance through the whole trial, and he suddenly decided that she couldn't have done what she was charged with doing. And there was... That was it. It was just that simple. There wasn't any way to glean from him earlier that he was going to do that.
And he kept saying, you know, I need more, needing more evidence. And it was like, what else can you do? So apparently what happened was he just kept holding out, and then he flipped on a couple of the counts, and that kind of turned the case for you guys. Is that correct?
Yeah. Ultimately, she was charged with 9 counts of murder, not the death penalty, because for a lot of evidentiary reasons, it just didn't seem that it was going to be possible to go there. So, but she was facing life without possibility of parole in prison. So the evidence on 7 of the victims was pretty much identical, and it was on that evidence that this one juror said he just didn't think it was enough. The other jurors, the other 11 jurors, were absolutely adamant, and it took a lot of jury deliberation to get this guy to agree to convict her on 3 counts.
That's interesting. He did flip on 3 counts, but he said that's enough because you keep asking for more. Have you seen that type of behavior? Because to me it seemed like weird that he would actually flip. He just wanted, it sounded like he wanted it to be over with, so he made some concessions, and that was it. Then he got to a certain point where he didn't want to be, quote-unquote, kind of, seem to be taken advantage of or whatever, but in his mind, what's your thought when you get a juror like that with that type of behavior? Is that common?
Luckily it isn't, but I think that does happen. That's why I described that case at Folsom Prison, the case with 3 defendants. Sometimes a juror, for whatever reason, because everybody comes to a jury with their own experiences and their own prejudices and preconceptions about stuff, they just decide that it's not enough and it's never going to be enough. When that's kind of the toss of the dice with juries. You really can't tell.
As a human being, and then as a prosecutor, and going through your experiences, has your view of crime and punishment changed at all? In other words, you know, maybe a lot of people who aren't in touch with the criminal system from a hands-on perspective, they might have a very liberal view of it, and then when, you know, they're victims of a crime or something, then they change. You being you know, in a prosecutional function, seeing what actual people do to each other, has that changed the way you view, like, good and evil and people and crime and punishment? I mean, like, for instance, would you, and I'm not going to ask you for your specific opinion, but it could be like, well, I was never for the death penalty, but then I saw what these people really do, and it's like, why waste the money on them in prison, and like, whatever. I mean, has your point of view changed, William?
No, to be honest with you, not as far as that goes. I do think the death penalty is necessary in some cases. And as far as the rest of it, I think for the death penalty and almost every other thing that happens in the criminal justice system, you know, we have to simply make the we have to take the leap and say it's not going to be perfect. There will be mistakes. On balance, it's going to have to be as good as it possibly can be. But you have to accept the fact that there isn't going to be perfect. There will not be perfect justice the way it's done. You just can't get there. The thing that actually interested me. There was a forensic psychiatrist I talked to who interviewed many serial killers and just, ordinary killers. And there was only one case that actually stood out in his mind. And he actually had interviewed Richard Chase, in fact. The case that scared the heck out of him was, he was a truck driver who got into a bar fight. But what was interesting was that when the psychiatrist interviewed him, the fight involved another patron at the bar, but this truck driver, who was not a big guy, was actually fairly small, he literally almost tore this guy to pieces. During the interview, the psychiatrist came to the conclusion that there were actually three distinct personalities in this guy. Two were kind of benign, but there was one, as the psychiatrist told me, he said it just made the hair on the back of my neck go up. That's when the psychiatrist, who was he's pretty much of a secular guy. He says, I just absolutely believe in evil at that point, because he thought he had actually seen it.
Wow, that's fascinating. So with this book, is she still alive?
No, she died about, I'm not absolutely sure at the moment. She died about 4 or 5 years ago in prison. She was a model prisoner the second time through as she was the first time through. The first time through, most of the younger female inmates would approach her as kind of a confessor, a friend, and then she would use that information, if she could, to make deals with the prison authorities to get herself some privileges.
So she's a total manipulator. I mean, it sounds like the woman had charisma, and I'm sure a lot of people involved in crime do.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. She was not. She was fairly intelligent. But she was a complete sociopath.
Now, from your career and making your moves, do you have any insights or regrets, or like, I'm glad I made the move when I did, and how much are you enjoying what you're doing now versus what you were doing before, and kind of what's next for you, William?
More writing, I think. It's one of those questions when if you ask somebody who's a writer, you'll probably get different answers on different days. Some days, the page looks like it's halfway decent and you feel pretty good about it. The following day you look at it, you realize somebody has gotten in and taken your good page and put a piece of junk in its place. On balance, I would say, no, I'm very glad I'm doing what I'm doing.
Now, do you, for your novels, do you, like, write an outline first and then go out and then kind of fill it in, or do you just, like, I'm going to write about this particular case that I have in mind, and maybe it's a tapestry of a real case and something that I've added in to spice it up?
I'm not an outline writer, I have to be honest. I'm more interested, frankly, in kind of being a writer who's almost a reader. I like to know what's going on as it's happening. When I was writing Sudden Impact, for example, all I really knew was I had a judge, I knew who he was, I knew who the victim, the cop, was, and I knew who these two detectives, Terry Nye and his partner Rose Tafoya, I knew who they were. But beyond the fact that this accident happened and the judge just kept driving. I actually didn't know what was going to happen after that, so the whole story kind of unfolded as it did for the characters.
Now, are your the books that became movies, are they available to our audience, like on Netflix, or, you know, can you rent them? I guess Netflix now, nobody's renting movies anymore.
Yeah, things
sorry.
Changed. No,
go down
true.
To Blockbuster, right? No, I don't think so.
Rampage is streaming on Netflix, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
And Broken Trust is available on DVD from Warner Archive.
And now, are you pleased with how your books were handled when they were translated? And did you have any? I know one of the screenplays you did not write. What was your feeling about that process in terms of your getting involved, not getting involved, and what ultimately went on screen?
I have to say I'm just an extremely lucky guy. In both cases of the pictures that got made, William Friedkin was, you know, generous and gracious from the very beginning in terms of keeping me involved in what he was doing and showing me rough cuts of things.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise with Broken Trust, I didn't see that actually till its premiere, which was in Rockefeller Center.
Wow.
But, that's all I can say. I was very lucky. I think they turned out spectacularly.
Did you go to the shoots?
A little bit, actually. But part of the problem is most directors don't like to have screenwriters around when they're shooting.
Right.
And a novelist is sometimes even less interesting. Part of the problem is actors usually want to talk to you about making their roles bigger.
Of course,
but directors
yeah.
don't like that.
Yeah, exactly. So what's next for you, William?
Well, I'm going to wait to see. I'm working on a book right now, also involving Terry Nye and Rose, because, frankly, I found them just a lot of fun to be
yeah.
around. Trying to sell Sudden Impact as a movie.
Oh, fantastic. Well, tell our first of all, you've been a fantastic guest and you're a great writer, and I urge everybody to, you know, either go to the bookstore or go online and download or buy these books. They're very well written and very interesting. Tell our listeners where they can find more about you, your website, and where they can best places that you want them to go to find your books.
Oh, thank you very much for those. That's very generous of you, Robert. Well, the best place probably is to go to my website, which is www. This is all one word. William P. P as in Paul. WilliamPWoodBooks.com, and that everything you can pretty much get from there.
Oh, fantastic. Well, listen, I appreciate your coming on, and you're a great guest and very interesting person, and I hope you'll come back when your next book comes out, and it's been a pleasure meeting you, and I really enjoyed our conversation, William.
I did, too. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure for me, too.
All right. Well, stay well, and everybody, it's William P. Wood. The Bone Garden is the new book, The Chilling True Story of a Female Serial Killer, and also Sudden Impact, which is a novel. So, thanks, everybody, for listening in. That wraps up another Guys, Guys radio podcast. Next week, we actually have another author on, Joseph Bailey, who wrote a book about the Muppets, Memoirs of a Muppet Writer. So we're going to talk about a little something different there. And I hope you all have a great week. Enjoy the World Cup. Enjoy the great weather. We've got summer solstice coming up on the 21st, which is, I believe, is Saturday. And then the days start to get shorter, actually. So all the best to everybody. And remember that what Guys Guys stand for is, better men, better world. And keep us in mind because Guys Guys finish first.